Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevayam.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So the reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 14. King Chitraketu's Lamentation. All right, now we got up to text number 5. Which is an important verse, a very significant purport describing the rarity of becoming a devotee of the Lord. And Srila Prabhupada and Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, quoting various verses from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, and Bhagavad Gita, Chapter 9, explaining that those who have gained some result in karma, jnana, or yoga, who do not have sufficient merit in bhakti, do not get the results of their activities, and rather they are all ruined. Whereas someone who may even be on the path where there are some significant sins and offences, if they later take to the path of pure devotional service without offence, they are considered to be successful in gaining the results of their activities, and some may even become pure devotees. Thus, bhakti is the significant element of anyone's activities. And amongst all of the different personalities, it is extremely rare for someone to have elevated themselves up through the various rungs of the yoga ladder and become a pure devotee of the Lord. There was a nice verse quoted from the Tantra Bhagavata by Madhvacharya, Srila Madhvacharya, saying that there are 90 million demigods and 70 million sages. That gives a total of 160 million. And they're all devotees, or what we call Narayana, Narayanayana, devotees of the Lord. Among them, only a few are called Narayana Parayana. So they say that the demigods are lining up to take birth in the Sankirtan movement. So amongst the 90 million demigods and the 70 million sages, some of them may be lining up to become devotees and join ISKCON. Yeah.
Because it says 90 million demigods, we heard that it's 33 million.
Yeah. Prabhupada, you say that 23 million demigods.
Yeah.
So 90
Yeah, well, so 33 million demigods, you would have to consider that that 33 million are particularly significant. And amongst those 33 million significant demigods, there are others.
It used to be 33 crores, which is an, I don't know, crores and...
Are you saying, is that...
Crore is 10 million, 330 million.
33 million. So then, amongst the 33 million principal demigods, there's, you know, many more who are various sages and, you know, associates within the, you know... the realm of the demigods. So, you know, just like, you know, if you said there is so many ministers, you know, within the cabinet, and how many secretaries and, you know, janitors serve those, you know, principal cabinet members and what have you. So, some of those 90 million demigods and 70 million sages will end up in ISKCON. And they are called Narayanayana, the devotees of Lord Narayana. But amongst them, you know, those who are Narayana, Parayana, very rare. So more rare than the demigods that may line up and become part of ISKCON are the actual pure devotees that may be there within ISKCON. And Vrityasura is one of those Narayana Parayana devotees, and he's from a demon background, so very surprising, you know, Vrityasura's position. Even amongst the demigods and the sages, as describing here, very few pure devotees, Narayana Parayana. And even more rare amongst the demons, and Narayana Parayana. So his position is very rare. That's what we understand. we'll continue. But... Vrityasura was situated in the blazing fire of battle and was an infamous sinful demon, always engaging in troubles and anxieties to others. How could such a demon become so greatly Krishna conscious? So he wants to know, what is the reason for his advancement, his spiritual advancement? My dear Lord, Sukadeva Goswami, although Vrityasura was a sinful demon, he showed the prowess of a most exalted Kshatriya and satisfied Lord Indra in battle. How could such a demon be a great devotee of Lord Krishna? These contradictions have caused me great doubt and they have made me eager to hear of this from you.
Prabhu, is the term sinful appropriate here, given that Vrityasura was actually a sinful demon, or is it just for language?
No. No, what would usually be considered forbidden activity, some of that he engaged in. I mean, for instance, Indra is the king of heaven. To insult him, to physically harm him, to obstruct his management of the universe, all of these things are simple activities.
But then it's Indra who attacked him first, mm-hmm. I mean, out of fear. I mean, he may have attacked him, but actually it is a demigod who attacks the demons because they are afraid when they are seen to be so powerful.
Hmm. Well, it's you know, so for instance, if say the government sends a squad of you know police to your home to arrest you, and you think, oh, you know, you're instigating trouble in my home, therefore I will attack you. Actually, you're breaking the law. Even if you haven't done anything wrong, if the police come and, you know, kick down your door to arrest you, you're still against the law to attack them back.
Because you can defend yourself, right?
No, that's called resisting arrest. That's another stint in jail you'll do.
If the police is doing something, they are themselves corrupt.
Exactly,
yeah.
Even if they're doing something corrupt, if you say, yes, I stabbed the police officer because he was a corrupt police officer anyway, you'll be charged with the same offence as stabbing a police officer who's not corrupt.
No, but this is a self-defence.
Huh?
You are allowed to defend yourself.
No. If you resist, that's called resisting arrest. If you lay a finger on them, it's against the law. Srila Goswami said, after hearing Maharaj Parikshit's very intelligent question, Sukadeva Goswami, the most powerful sage, began answering his disciple with great affection. Sri Sukadeva Goswami said, O King, I shall speak to you the same history I have heard from the mouths of Vyasadeva, Narada and Devala. Please listen with attention. O King Parikshit, in the province of Surasena, there was a king named Chitraketu who ruled the entire earth. During his reign, the earth produced all the necessities of life. This Chitraketu had 10 million wives. But although he was capable of producing children, he did not receive a child from any of them. By chance, all the wives were barren. No, they're all barren.
How could they remember
all barren, 10 million wives
barren? You know, I almost asked the Australian population.
Yeah, that's right. All barren. Chitraketu, trying to think what yuga we're in Vaivishvata Manu yuga, Vaivishvata, the current Manu, right? The battle between Britishura and Indra began in the Satya Yuga and then jumped into the Treta Yuga. So you would have to assume, therefore, that Chitraketu lived in the Satya Yuga.
In this
same manner, yeah.
Obviously, this was before Indra, so...
Prabhupada mentioned. Now, Chitraketu, the husband of these millions of wives, you know, you're surprised he had 10 million wives. You know, what's surprising is, you know, how do you look after 10 million wives? You know, that's what surprised me. That's a big, big house, yeah, big backyard.
It's actually all over the country, at least.
Big pay packet. And 10 million wives.
It does.
All gone.
It does sound a bit far-fetched, but
yeah. Well, you know, he's that means that he tried to impregnate each and every one of these wives.
So the Treta Yuga, even Lord Ramachandra accepted only one wife. Just to show that
he probably
the
So, you know, it's quite...
This day of Brahma, today, as in this day of Brahma?
Yeah.
This is what's happening. So it's still the same day of Brahma.
Yeah. So, you know, you got to consider how powerful these personalities are. Even, you know, when he falls from this position, he becomes someone who's able to fight personally with Indra. So, you know, he's not an ordinary king, you know, and that's in his, you know, apparently, you know, falling from a greater position to a lesser position, and still he's fighting, you know, so he's... you know, these various demigods or personalities, you know, who may be interacting with the demigods, you know, they're not ordinary personalities. You know, they're greatly powerful.
In text 10, it says there was a king named Chitraketu who ruled the entire earth.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, someone ruling the earth in, say, in the period of Satya Yuga, you know, they're not ordinary personalities. I mean, you know, at that stage, Satya Yuga, you've got demigods are still interacting with the rulers, you know, so... you know, they're not ordinary human beings. But, you know, the interesting thing here was, you know, if you said he had 10,000 wives, we'd have difficulty accepting that. Because that's not possible according to our calculations either. Or to speak of 1,000 wives, you know, even that, you know, is way beyond our calculation. Once it goes beyond your calculation, yeah, whether it be 1 million, 5 million, you know, if you said 8 million, oh yeah, I can accept maybe 8.5 million, you know, wives. 9 max, not 10, you know. And so, you know, after you get past, you know, three, you've got me, you know. It's, so, you know, there, it shows you the, you know, what's possible, even within the material world. And it's interesting that, you know, Krishna accepted 16,100 wives, which is far less.
Greater than Krishna.
Much greater.
But Krishna lived, but Krishna had 10 children, at least, to each wife.
I think the motive was to have a child.
For Chitrakati?
Because he had to leave a progeny. He
did not learn a lesson then. After 1 million, he should have stopped or something.
2, 10, 10 million. There's a few lessons in this one. there's a few good lessons.
Actually, I'm not, of course, we'll come to that, but I'm not sure what we can learn from that. I mean, as we go ahead.
Let's see where it leads.
Because he's not meant to have a child at all with so many wives, because even his son dies apparently.
Yeah, you know, at what stage would someone like us give up? I was just saying downstairs, I had 5 daughters, and I never tried for a son, purposely, because, you know, I thought, you throw a son in amongst 5 girls, you know, this is going to be, I don't know how he's going to go, you know. 5 girls are easy to look after, actually, we'll go pass the clothes down. My mother used to make all their clothes, the hand-knitted and everything, and hand-sewn. The clothes that she made for the first child were still in perfect condition for the last. These days, you buy something Kmart, 2 weeks later, it's finished. All of a sudden, comes undone, material. So, but I did end up with 1 son, Govardhan. I've told you that story. So everything is complete in Krishna consciousness. And that's what we'll see with Chitrakati. So Prabhupada mentions in his purport, it appears that the king first married 1 wife, but she could not bear a child. Then he married a 2nd, 3rd, 4th and so on, but none of the wives could bear children, as Nirmala was saying. In spite of the material assets of Janmasvariya Shuddha Sri, birth in an aristocratic family with full opulence, wealth, education and beauty, he was very much aggrieved because in spite of having so many wives, he had no son. Certainly his grief was natural. Grihastha life does not mean having a wife and no children. Chanakya Pandit says, Putra Hinam Griham Sunyam. If a family man has no son, his home is no better than a desert. The king was certainly most unhappy that he could not get a son, and this is why he had married so many times. Kshatriyas especially are allowed to marry more than 1 wife, and this king did so. Nonetheless, he had no issue. So, we know in the story of Ramanujacharya, Jamunacharya, he defeated the pundit by saying that the the king's wife is barren. Prove that the king's wife is not barren, and you know. It's said that Actually, if they have one son, they're still considered barren, technically, I think it is. So Chitraketu was very sad. From here, I mean, we should start to get an indication of something very significantly wrong. To rule the entire world in Satyayuga, the opulence, to be able to, have 10 million wives, the opulence is quite mind-boggling. To have 10 million wives, you would think somewhere, you can find, happiness with all that opulence, surrounded by so many wives. And yet, despite everything that he did have, he lamented the one thing he didn't have. And that is the nature of the mind, hankering, lamenting, that even we have so much, the mind will lament the little thing we don't have. It's a very significant factor in our lives. I come across this a lot because I deal with a lot of people who want some astrological advice and what have you, and it's very, very common that there's a great disturbance to the mind, a great void, inability to find happiness, because something that the person is trying to attempt, they're not attaining. And what's fascinating is that usually, in every case, the persons have so many things which are literally coming to them almost without effort, and yet the mind doesn't focus on any of that as a source of happiness. So many things for each and every person on this planet, practically, many things come without, many things come without effort, without, just naturally. But the thing that has to be achieved with extreme endeavor, that is where the mind focuses. And, in many cases, sometimes, the easy thing is, okay, if such a thing which will take up the best part of your life, struggling for the one thing that perhaps is always going to be somewhat elusive, and to chase that, the person will neither attain that much happiness from it, endure great unhappiness chasing it, and all the things they could enjoy by right the very moment which have come of their own accord, they take no happiness in it. And that is the nature of the mind, and that is the nature of Maya, material energy. So this is what we're seeing here. So, one thing I've always said to my children and generally to people who ask advice on different things is that those things which come freely of their own accord, you take full advantage of those things in life. And it's surprising, although that seems to be quite simple and logical, it is very rare that people do that. Most of us are chasing something which is extremely difficult and neglecting those things which are in fact already present within our life in a very easy way.
We take that for granted.
We do.
Take it for granted.
And you know, it's therefore another another motto that I like to live by is that therefore there should never be even one day goes past where you do not have something to celebrate with great jubilation.
The mind with what is said, it looks for something hard, with the chanting of the holy name. It's an easy process. What is it? What is difficult? People say, no, I can't. We have the Hare Krishna mantra, Srimad Bhagavatam.
We can sit, take association, so many things. So practically every day, you know, the test is if on a certain day you're not celebrating the wonderful things that you've got, it means you're in Maya because you're not seeing all the things that have come of their own accord by the grace of God. And every day we should be able to celebrate. Oh, this is another day of celebration. And the day you don't celebrate means you're no longer seeing what is all the wonderful things that are there. Again, the Maya, the mind then is chasing something different. His queens all had beautiful faces and attractive eyes. And that also includes as devotees. You know, that's not just on the material platform. We do that as devotees, that just like we're doing Bhakti Shastri, we do Bhakti Bhai Bhava. You know, the happiness, the satisfaction, the success doesn't come at the end when you get the certificate. The happiness just comes at every moment that, yes, I am, you know, engaged in studying the Srimad Bhagavatam today in a proper way. And should we be thinking, yes, then, you know, I will be nicely situated devotee when I can take initiation or take Brahman or take Vanaprastha or take sannyas or get some position or some status, you know, or get some recognition for my services or get some office or get some facility. You know, all of these same, it's the same thing that we do in the material world and then it enters our devotional life. And, you know, instead of just being satisfied that, you know, and this is what we see with Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada had a mission to give Krishna consciousness to everyone within the world. But he wasn't waiting to be happy for some thing. You know, every day he enjoyed to get up and chant Hare Krishna. Every day he enjoyed to give class. Every day he enjoyed to speak to whoever would come and listen. Every day he enjoyed prasad. You see this picture over here? Mm-hmm. Prabhupada sitting, so much enjoying. He's turned facing the wall here. Yeah, facing the wall, just absorbed in the prasadam. So not that our happiness comes when so many big things or big projects, but just moment by moment, and that's called Krishna consciousness. What is that? That this very second, Krishna is with us. That's enough. Right? If we don't think that's enough, then we're not Krishna conscious. At every moment Krishna is with us, that's enough. There's nothing more to be achieved. Krishna is there, Prabhupada is satisfied, like that. So these things, they're material, but they also, infiltrate our devotional mentality. So his queens all had beautiful faces and attractive eyes, yet neither his opulences, his hundreds and thousands of queens, nor the lands of which he was the supreme proprietor, were sources of happiness for him. Once upon a time, when the powerful sage named Angira was travelling all over the universe without engagement, by his sweet will, he came to the palace of Chitraketu. So you can see here that Krishna, arranges these pastimes to show that the extent of Maya, that when someone is in the material state of consciousness, it doesn't matter how unlimitedly, beyond what we can imagine, our material assets and aspirations are fulfilled when the material energy is there, when we're in Maya or illusion, lamenting, subject to the mind, hankering and lamenting. Even we get 10 million wives and Satya Yuga and proprietor of all the lands, it will never get to the point where, I've missed that one thing, but if I'll make up for it with all the other things. That's the trick of Maya. We think, I really want this thing to enjoy, I can't get that, but if I just keep making up with so many other things, then that doesn't work either. The mind will just still hanker for that one thing that we don't have.
At
that time, there was no adoption, is it? Satya Yuga, you could have adopted it. No, I think the agency shut down at the end of Kali Yuga. Once upon a time, when the powerful sage named Angira was travelling all over the universe without engagement, by his sweet will, he came to the palace of King Chitraketu. Chitraketu immediately stood up from his throne and offered him worship. He offered drinking water and eatables, and in this way performed his duty as a host to a great guest. When the Rishi was seated very comfortably, the king, restraining his mind and senses, sat on the ground at the side of the Rishi's feet. O King Parikit. When Chitraketu bent low in humility, was seated at the lotus feet of the great sage. The sage congratulated him for his humility and hospitality. The sage addressed him in the following words. So it's very nice. You see here is the mood of perfectly exemplified. So Chitraketu is being very humble and hospitable to the sage. But the sage is not thinking, yes, so you're doing the correct thing because, I am a great sage. And therefore, just accepting that worship without any reciprocation. I see devotees do that they become proud. So when someone offers some service, they think, yes, that's what you should be doing. because that is your position. And my position is that I am a senior devotee, and your position is that you should offer me service like that. So that they accept that without... here, you know, Angira is... He's actually congratulating. That's really nice. You know, thank you. You know, it's nice. And, you know, just like actually, whenever Prabhupada used to give a lecture, at the end of the lecture, he'd say, "Thank you very much." Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, that's very nice. You sat and you listened to me. Yeah, thank you very much. Like that. Every lecture. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Not yet, so you should listen to me, you know, because I'm in the superior position. Not like that, you know, not like, you know, just taking everyone's, you know, service for granted. Like that. You know, when people serve prasadam, you know, they thank you, you know. Yeah, you know, so you should serve me, you know. Yeah, put some on my plate, you know. So it's a nice, you know, nice etiquette, good etiquette. The sage Angira said, "My dear king, I hope that your body and mind and your royal associates and paraphernalia are well. When the seven properties of material nature, the total material energy, the ego and the five objects of sense gratification, are in proper order, the living entity within the material elements is happy. Without these seven elements, one cannot exist. Similarly, a king is always protected by seven elements: his instructor, the Swami or Guru, his ministers, his kingdom, his fort, his treasury, his royal order, and his friends." So Prabhupada would quite often say, a king is never alone. He has his retinue. What's the other word? Another word. He first has his spiritual master, Prabhupada says, the supreme guide. Then come his ministers. His kingdom, his fortifications, his treasury, his system of law and order. You know, in the translation it's got his royal order, and Prabhupada says his system of law and order, and his friends and allies. If these seven are properly maintained, the king is happy. Similarly, as explained in Bhagavad Gita, the living entity, the soul, is within the material covering of the Mahatattva, ego, and Panchatanmatra, the five objects of sense gratification. When these seven are in proper order, the living entity is in a mood of pleasure. Generally, when the associates of the king are quiet and obedient, the king can be happy. Therefore, the great sage Angira Rishi inquired about the king's personal health and good fortune of his seven associates. When we inquire from a friend whether everything is well, we are concerned not only with his personal self, but also with his family, his source of income, and his assistants or servants. All of them must be well, then a person can be happy. O King, O Lord of humanity, when a king directly depends upon his associates and follows their instructions, he is happy. Similarly, when his associates offer their gifts and activities to the king and follow his orders, they are also happy. Prabhupada mentions that A king should not simply give orders to his dependents because he is supreme. Sometimes he must follow their instructions. Similarly, the dependents should depend on the king. This mutual dependence will make everyone happy. So we see here that the natural order of a leader is that they have not just a spiritual master, but they also have ministers who sometimes give them instructions. And that's proper. We can imagine how powerful King Chitraketu is as a leader, a manager, an administrator. And yet, he is not exempt from having ministers who he should take instruction from. That is natural. A leader who does not take instructions from the ministers cannot be properly situated. The natural rule. O king, are your wives, citizens, secretaries and servants and the merchants who sell spices and oil under your control? Are you also in full control of ministers, the inhabitants of your palace, your provincial governors, your sons and other dependents? Prabhupada says the master or king and his subordinates should be interdependent. Through cooperation, both of them can be happy. If the king's mind is fully controlled, all his family members and governmental officers are subordinate to him. His provincial governors present taxes on time without resistance, and what to speak of lesser servants. O King Chitraketu, I can observe that your mind is not pleased. You seem not to have achieved your desired goal. Is this because of yourself, of you yourself, or has it been caused by others? Your pale face reflects your deep anxiety. Sukadeva Goswami said, O King Parikshit, although the great sage and Gira knew everything, he inquired from the king in this way. Thus King Chitraketu, desiring his son, bent low in great humility and spoke to the great sage as follows. Prabhupada says, since the face is the index of the mind, the saintly person can study the condition of one's mind by seeing his face. When Angira Rishi remarked about the king's discoloured face, King Chitraketu explained the cause of his anxiety as follows. So it is said, the face is the index of the mind and the eyes are the window to the soul. The eyes are the window to the soul. King Chitraketu said, O great Lord, Angira, because of austerity, knowledge and transcendental samadhi, you are freed from all the reactions of sinful life. Therefore, as a perfect yogi, you can understand everything external and internal regarding embodied conditioned souls like us. O great soul, you are aware of everything, yet you are asking me why I am full of anxiety. Therefore, in response to your order, let me disclose the cause. As a person aggrieved by hunger and thirst is not pleased by the external gratification of flower garlands or sandalwood pulp, I am not pleased with my empire, opulence or possessions which are desirable even for great demigods because I have no son. So there you see that so vast was his empire and opulence that even the demigods, great demigods, desired that level of opulence. So we can just see, you know, extraordinary opulence and power, possessions. Therefore, O great sage, please save me and my forefathers who are descending to the darkness of hell because I have no progeny. Kindly do something so that I may have a son to deliver us from hellish conditions. Report. According to Vedic civilization, one gets married simply to have a son who is needed to offer oblations to his forefathers. King Chitraketu responsibly desired to beget a child so that he and his forefathers might be delivered from the darkest regions. He was concerned with how to get Pindar oblations in the next life, not only for himself but also for his forefathers. Therefore he requested Angira Rishi to favour him by doing something that could help him get a son. In response to the request of Maharaj Chitraketu, Angira Rishi, who was born of Lord Brahma's mind, was very merciful toward him. Because the sage was a greatly powerful personality, he performed the sacrifice by offering oblations of sweet rice to Tvashta. Who was Tvashta? Yeah, the father of Vishwarupa. And later he also conjured up Vrishura from the fire.
There's a couple of
Tvashtas here. There's a few Tvashtas here.
So actually he becomes
Chitraketu's father. As in Vrishura's father.
From the fire, Chitraketu comes out.
In that sense, Vishvarupa and Vrishura were brothers. They're both born in different ways from Tvashta. Now, here, Agira Rishi performed a sacrifice and is offering oblations of sweet rice to Tvashta.
I think
there's some connection. Sometimes it just doesn't say.
Yeah, he was not born yet.
Tvashta's not born. Who is that? So text number 28. Parikit Maharaj, best of the Bharatas, the remnants of the food offered in the Jagya were given by the great sage Angira to the first and most perfect among Chitraketu's millions of queens, whose name was Kritajyoti. Thereafter, the great sage told the king, O great king, now you have a son who will be the cause of both jubilation and lamentation. The sage then left without waiting for Chitraketu's response. So, harsha means jubilation and shoka means lamentation. Harsha shoka. The king was overwhelmed with joy when he understood he would have a son. Because of his great jubilation, he could not actually understand the statement of the sage Angira. He accepted it to mean that there would certainly be jubilation because of the birth of his future son, but that he would be the king's only son, and being very proud of his great wealth and empire, would not be very obedient to his father. Thus the king was satisfied, thinking, let there be a son, it does not matter if he's not very obedient. In Bengal there is a proverb that instead of having no maternal uncle, it is better to have a maternal uncle who is blind. The king accepted this philosophy, thinking that a disobedient son would be better than no son at all. The great sage Chanakya Pandit says, what is the use of a son who is neither a learned scholar nor a devotee? Such a son is like a blind, diseased eye, which always causes suffering. Nevertheless, the material world is so polluted that one wants to have a son even though he is useless. This attitude is represented in the history of King Chitraketu.
What I found interesting was, in Kali Yuga, we have people, like teenagers, getting pregnant so easily and all that. They say that actually having a child is a blessing. And Kali Yuga full of false people, they get pregnant. They don't want children, they get pregnant. But here there's a pious king, and all in Satya Yuga they're talking about it, they can't have children. I find that really amazing. Really.
He had a legitimate reason as well to continue his portion to kingdom.
No, no. The basically Satya Yuga is when there are pious. Pious people, they have children.
Yeah, so he should have.
Yeah, but here in Kali Yuga, actually having a child is a blessing. It's a God's gift.
They don't want, but they haven't.
That's a
different,
yeah.
Well, it just shows you can't avoid your suffering, that you're destined, despite the material circumstances that are prevailing. So, you know, if your destiny is to suffer, so you would think that, okay, you know, someone is the ruler of the entire world in Satya Yuga, 10 million wives, so much opulence, no way I'm going to suffer. But that person, if they're destined to suffer, they'll suffer. And then you can have someone in Kali Yuga, destitute, you know, without anything, and if they're destined to be happy, then despite all the circumstances of Kali Yuga, they can go through, you know, a battlefield and still, you know, somehow have a reasonable, you know, nice, you know, existence. So, you know, it's you can't overcome your destiny, you know, by material arrangements. That's basically what I would take out of that. You know, if you're destined to suffer, then it doesn't matter where you are in this material world, high or low, or which time period you're in, you'll suffer. You can't. No material arrangements will override it. You know, people think that. You know, you see people who, you know, they live in the war-torn zones of Africa, and you know, somewhere like that, and they think, oh, I'll go to Australia and live a better life. And they come over here, and you know, whereas in Africa, there's like practically everyone on the streets trying to kill them, and they might come to Melbourne. There may be just one person on one day who's, you know, got some killer streak in them, and they attack that person and, you know, cause them trouble. So they, you know, they're the one unlucky person, you know, that this one person on this one day happens to, you know. So they've come to a country where relatively they should be safe, but, you know, so therefore there's a saying, wherever you go, you take the weather with you. Wherever you go, you take your karma with you.
Remember a really short story. Mm. One of the king, you know, he is cursed to die, you know, not Parashit, basically, of the snake. Mm. So he goes into the middle of the ocean, and he lives there, you know, thinking that no snake will come. Mm. But the snake comes through the lemon, through the lemon, the worm, it grows into a snake and bites him.
Sri Ram told me a story, Prishni's husband, Sri Ram, that I think his great grandfather, back in that time, grandfather, great grandfather, Sri Ram, Prishni's husband.
Sri Ram.
Yeah. And he told me the story that a child was born. And the astrology predicted the child would die on such and such a day, very early in life, being bitten by a snake. Not long after. And so, on that day, they decided that what they would do is they would hold the child, all day and make sure the snake didn't bite it. So they wouldn't let it out of their sight, and they held him. And then what happened is that practically you come to the time where, they thought, there's about a minute to go, there's no way, there's no sign of snakes, like that. And I think she passed him to the husband, said, I have to, go and get something, next door or something. And he thought, pretty much the time has passed, and he put him down, the snake bit him, killed him, he didn't see it. So,
Prabhu, this is a true story about a devotee. I think as a devotee boy, every day, I think I read it in one of the magazines. He used to, very unusually, that boy was very keen on Bhagavatam, and he used to hear Bhagavatam, and he used to sit, not move. It is happening that one day during Bhagavatam, unusually the boy got up and he went outside. Then after the class got over and they went, so the boy had gone into a well there and he got drowned. So a boy who never leaves Bhagavatam class.
One time in
his fate had dragged him.
Did an astrological chart for a devotee in New Zealand, and when I saw his chart, he had a really bad chart. One of the worst. A lot of danger and suffering to come his way. Anyway, somehow or another, he ended up. He was on the farm. He was a new Arshan. He was just doing some steady work around the farm every day, but he's having a little difficulty with some devotees, and it caused him some mental anxiety. And he asked me for some advice, and I said, because he was thinking, this is causing me some suffering. And I said, well, from what I see, if that's all the suffering you're undergoing, then Krishna has taken your suffering away. And whatever you do, don't give up your service, don't leave the farm, because in your chart, the suffering is hundreds of fold, and as soon as you get up your devotional service, then you really see what your destiny is. And so, as usual, he didn't take my advice. However, he left the farm. Yeah, because there was a little disturbance, this vegetation. I saw him a few years later, and he looked like death warmed up. And he was scarred from head to toe. He looked terrible. He looked like he'd come out of a war zone. And I said to him, what happened? You look like you've undergone some. He said, yes, I left the farm. I had a major car accident. I got a girlfriend. We ended up having a fight. I got stabbed. I got bashed. I got, thrown in jail. And, apparently, every bad thing that you could imagine that could happen to a person happened to him within that 2 years. You know, he was just a complete mess, and his life was a complete mess from there on in. He did so much damage in that period of time that he literally spoiled his entire life within that time. So because, you know, but he felt that there was some difficulty, and I could see that, you know, yes, you're suffering, but it's nothing to what I see, you know, in your chart like that. So, you know, the destiny. And as you're saying, you know, he left the Bhagavatam class, went out and, you know, drowned. Here, you know, the boy, he left his service. Prabhupada once said, you know, a devotee asked him about astrology. Prabhupada was saying that, you know, Prabhupada had different things. You know, he would say that, you know, with one kick, Krishna can kick away 10 million Rahus, and, you know, and he was saying that, you know, when you become a devotee, you know, all of that, you know, destiny that's there in your chart and, you know, what have you, it's all taken away. But he says, if you give up your devotional service, Krishna will give it all back to you. So it's not exactly karma, but, you know, it's like you can't trick Krishna that you've taken my karma now I'm going to go and enjoy without that karma. And Krishna says, yeah, well, you don't have any karma, but I'm still going to make you suffer because I'm God. I can do it. I don't need you to have karma for me to cause you trouble, you know. So, yeah. Interesting. So, and here, again, this is how, you know, quite often being an astrologer, you know, you have to give people a certain amount of advice. And it's always interesting, you know, when people hear one thing that you've said and not the other thing, which is more important. So sometimes, you know, I remember one person, they were on the verge of doing something really foolish and, you know, giving up the devotional service, giving up their family and what have you. And I said, look, you know, you do that, in the long term, you'll cause yourself so much trouble. Short term, some happiness, some success. Long term, so much problem, you regret. And she said to me, shall I be successful? I said, yes, the long term. Shall I be successful? So they were thinking short term, you know. And the person actually did what I advised not to do, causing a lot of trouble. But, you know, it was exactly like this. You know, just playing out before me. You almost can't believe someone doing that. You know, it just boggles your mind. Like, you know, that you've said two things, you've spoken very logically and reasonably, and they just hear exactly what they want to hear, and the other, it doesn't register. Because they like Chitra Ketu, they filter it, add things to it. Take it away, adjust it. Instead of just taking exactly what you said, you know, they add little bits into it with their own. Prabhupada said, he used to say, don't be over-intelligent. Over-intelligent means we have a little bit of intelligence, just enough to get ourselves into trouble. You know, a little intelligence, I can add to that statement a little bit, I can adjust that, you know, with our over-intelligence. It's really another form of foolishness, but there's some intelligence there. But because it's misplaced, it equates to just being foolish. So, Chitra Ketu here is being a little over-intelligent, as Prabhupada would say. You know, he's adjusting something with his intelligence, and he shouldn't be doing that. That's over-intelligent. I mean, he's applying more intelligence than they'd be. Just listen and accept it as it is. And, you know, in other words, if we have just enough intelligence to hear from the right authority and accept it, that's all the intelligence we need. And when we have more than that, we're in trouble. As Kritika Devi, after receiving the semen of Lord Shiva from Agni, conceived a child. So, if you haven't missed much, we're really just after the next couple of verses, we're up to text number 30. Although we have been talking a lot. But we're talking about Chitraketu's over-intelligence, that he added things to Angira's statement that he shouldn't have. He should have just listened and accepted. And text number 30. As Kritika Devi, after receiving the semen of Lord Shiva from Agni, conceived a child named Skanda Kartikeya. Kritajyoti, having received semen from Chitraketu, became pregnant after eating remnants of food from a yajna performed by Angira.
So, Prabhu, when you say Chitraketu added to what Angira Muni said, so then what exactly is it, just a misunderstanding before that?
He thought that he had a bad son rather than lose his son altogether. They said it's okay. I mean, at least I'll have a son. Mm-hmm. Because he said your son will cause you happiness and distress.
Yeah. And then what he's done is he's thought, okay, I dare not think of what type of unhappiness my son could actually cause me, so I'm going to make up a little scenario that suits me. I dare not think of the worst case scenario because I'm just looking for happiness in the outcome. I don't want to look at that scenario, and so therefore, I'm going to, add a little to that. That when he says that the sun will cause me also some lamentation, it'll be really not much. You know, it'll be something like that. So he's really qualified. Adding more to that statement than what Angira did. Oh, it won't be much, he'll be a bad son,
He didn't clarify this.
Nor did he ask him to. He didn't. Yeah. Because he didn't. He wanted to hear what he wanted to hear.
But Angira Muni also went away before he could ask.
Yeah, but he could have asked him.
So basically, what should he do? He should have asked him.
Yeah, he could have asked him. So that's good. Yeah.
So what does he mean by lamentation? That's what he should have done.
Yeah. He could have inquired if he got the opportunity. Or he could have, he could have thought in this way. He could have thought, what if he caused me so much lamentation that he causes me jubilation? So maybe I should, not go ahead. So he could have thought in that way. But he didn't want to hear that he's going to suffer. So, his mind told him a little story that, he won't suffer too much. And he listened to his mind. And so his, the mind with its intelligence is adding little bits. And so he's
a jubilation.
Yeah.
The mind did not think about the lamentation.
He's being tricked by his own mind, yeah. There used to be a cartoon, the Flintstones, Fred Flintstone. Anyone ever seen that?
Yeah.
You ever see the episode where he's got there's a little Fred Flintstone on his shoulder, a little imaginary one who's like got the halo. He's the good side of Fred.
Mm.
And on the other shoulder, he's got the little devil Fred.
Mm.
And someone's told him to do something. He's got an opportunity to do something, and the good side of Fred is telling him to do this, and the bad side of Fred is telling him to do this. He ended up listening to the little devil Fred. So it's his own self. It's interesting because it's a cartoon, which means even little 5-year-old kids can understand that we sometimes, how old are you? What's he doing?
10.
So sometimes you know, we're going to do something, and one side of ourself is saying, do the right thing, and one side of ourself is saying, oh, do the other thing we might get in trouble for. And we sort of, you know, we can argue back and forth, right? So even little children can understand that. And you know, there it is in a cartoon with Fred Flintstone. So this is what Chitraketu is doing, you know, like the is you know, listening to the mind.
Indian cinema movies before,
yeah.
The heroine or hero will go and stand in front of the mirror. And the mirror will tell something, don't do that.
Yeah, that's right, that's right, then, yeah. You know, it's the same thing.
Like, you know, this
yeah.
is, but they had some meaning actually.
Yeah, that's right.
That is the whole mind talking. The mirror will say, don't kill the person. One more person, don't kill the person.
Well, Michael Jackson had a song, right? I'm starting with the man in the mirror. It's a very famous song. You know that song? Anyone know that song? Want to see me moonwalk? No, no. Michael Jackson had a song. So he was trying to, you know that song? I'm starting with the man in the mirror? No. Good. Excellent. Well done. He's only got the... he's got a good upbringing. If you don't know Michael Jackson, you've done well. So... where was I? A very famous song. He wanted to clean up the world, but he's saying, start with that person in the mirror. Me. Like that. So, you know, which is what you're saying. So it's actually a very famous song. Does anyone know that? Actually know that song? No. There you go. Just me.
Don't you know that song?
I do. I've got five daughters, and they've all gone through teenage years. I know all the songs.
You sing it, Prabhu?
I just did. I won't do it.
So that's the theme is good.
It's a very famous song. They play. Yeah, they still play.
The song could be famous without the theme being good. The theme is good here.
Mm.
You start with the
theme
yourself.
Nowadays, don't worry about the theme. You know, the song can be any
three tiers
or something.
No, but whatever it is.
It is,
this
yeah.
Same, that is there.
Yeah.
But the song, this seems to have a good theme.
Yeah. That's right. It is, yeah.
It's those days are the theme.
Yeah.
Nowadays.
The only thing was that actually... Everyone glorifies Michael Jackson as one of the, you know, as they do with pop stars and movie stars. They say that, but it's empty because he never did that. Because he was addicted to all sorts of intoxications and painkillers, and he wanted to clean his self up, but he never ever did. So the people look at him, yes, I want to be like Michael Jackson. He's starting with himself, he's cleaning up, you know, his own, you know, inner self and everything like that. So he's singing about it, but never actually did it. In fact, he's one of the worst role models, you know, like that. So that's the difference. So, you know, a lot of the, in, you know, at the moment in the world, we have all sorts of heroes, role models, but it is just, they can... have the charade, the mask, the superficiality, the clothes, you know, the words of someone of substance, but actually they don't have that substance. That's the difference. Prabhupada, you know, was an actual hero because, you know, if he spoke something. He was literally the best example of, you know, anything that he spoke of. He was, you know, the best example of that. And also Krishna, Ram, you know, these devotional heroes. So Kritika is also the name of one of the nakshatras, right? You know that? Yeah, that is. And, you know, it's interesting that Kritika, each nakshatra, we studied this in the fifth canto, you remember this? Each zodiac sign, which has 30 degrees, has 2 1/4 nakshatras. So each nakshatra takes up 13 degrees 20 minutes of the zodiac sign. Two of them makes 26 degrees 40 minutes, and that leaves 3 degrees 20 minutes, which is one quarter. Right? And Kritika begins in that last quarter of Aries. So the first pada, or the first quarter of the nakshatra, so each star has four quarters. So like when you ask, you know, when you look for the name or the sound of the syllable of a child astrologically, you look what pada. So there are four padas to a star. So if a person is born in the star of Kritika, then, you know, there are four possible sounds. If they're born in the first pada, first quarter, there's a sound. I'm not sure what it is. Second pada, a different sound like that. So that's how you get the syllable for the name. So Kritika is the, begins in the last, it's the first pada of Kritika begins in the last section of Aries, and then there's three other padas in Taurus, and the moon is actually exalted in Taurus. So when the moon goes through the star of Kritika, especially in Taurus, it's actually Kritika, so it's a very auspicious star. And the next star after Kritika is Rohini, in which Krishna was born, which is also, you know, where the moon is exalted, very, very auspicious. So Kritika received the seam of Lord Shiva from Agni, and conceived a child named Skanda or Kartikeya. From Kritika we get Kartikeya. So similarly, Krita Dyuti received the semen from Chitraketu after eating the remnants of food performed by Angira. So there's a via medium. So Agni was a via medium, and Angira was a via media, that's what it's saying. After receiving semen from Maharaj Chitraketu, the king of Surasena, Queen Krita Dyuti gradually developed in her pregnancy, O King Parikit, just as the moon develops during the bright fortnight. Thereafter, in due course of time, a son was born to the king. Hearing news of this, all the inhabitants of the state of Surasena were extremely pleased. King Chitraketu was especially pleased. After purifying himself by bathing and by decorating himself with ornaments, he engaged learned Brahmanas in offering benedictions to the child and performing the birth ceremony. Unto the Brahmanas who took part in the ritualistic ceremony, the king gave charity of gold, silver, garments, ornaments, villages, horses and elephants, as well as 60 crores of cows. 600 millions. So that means a crore is what? 10 million, is it? 10 million. One crore. As a cloud indiscriminately pours water on the earth, the beneficent King Chitraketu, to increase the reputation, opulence and longevity of his son, distributed like rainfall all desirable things to everyone. When a poor man gets some money after great difficulty, his affection for the money increases daily. Similarly, when King Chitraketu, after great difficulty, received a son, his affection for the son increased day after day. The mother's attraction and attention to the son, like that of the child's father, excessively increased. The other wives, seeing Krita Dyuti's son, were very much aggrieved, as if by high fevers, very much agitated, as if by high fevers, with a desire to have sons. As King Chitraketu fostered his son very carefully, his affection for Queen Krita Dyuti increased, but gradually he lost affection for the other wives who had no sons. Big mistake. Big mistake there. The other queens were extremely unhappy due to their being sonless. Because of the king's negligence towards them, they condemned themselves in envy and lamented. A wife who has no sons is neglected at home by her husband and dishonoured by her co-wives, exactly like a maidservant. Certainly, such a woman is condemned in every respect because of her sinful life. As stated, Prabhupada says by Chanaka Pandit, a person who has no mother at home and whose wife does not speak sweetly should go to the forest. For such a person, living at home and living in the forest are equal. Similarly, for a woman who has no son, who is not cared for by her husband, and whose co-wives neglect her, treating her like a maidservant, to go to the forest is better than to remain at home. It's interesting, you know. A person who has no mother at home should go to the forest. In Kali Yuga, it tends to work the other way, doesn't it? You know, if your mother is at home, go to the forest. It depends on the quality of the mother, really, doesn't it? Even maidservants who are constantly engaged in rendering service to the husband are honoured by the husband, and thus they have nothing for which to lament. Our position, however, is that we are maidservants of the maidservant, therefore we are most unfortunate. Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued, being neglected by their husband and seeing critical duties, opulence in possessing a son, Kriti duties, co-wives, always burned in envy, which became extremely strong. As their envy increased, they lost their intelligence, being extremely hard-hearted and unable to tolerate the king's neglect. They finally administered poison to the son, unaware of the poison administered by her co-wives. Queen Kriti duty walked within the house, thinking that her son was sleeping deeply. She did not understand that he was dead. Thinking that her child had been sleeping for a long time, Queen Kriti Judy, who was certainly very intelligent, ordered the nurse, "My dear friend, please bring my son here." When the maidservant approached the child, who was lying down, she saw that his eyes were turned upward. There were no signs of life, all his senses having stopped, and she could understand that the child was dead. Seeing this, she immediately cried, "Now I am doomed," and fell to the ground. In great agitation, the maidservant struck her breast with both hands and cried loudly in regretful words. Hearing a loud voice, the queen immediately came, and when she approached her son, she saw that he was suddenly dead. In great lamentation, her hair and dress in disarray, the queen fell to the ground unconscious. O King Parikit, hearing the loud crying, all the inhabitants of the palace came, both men and women. Being equally grieved, they also began to cry. The queens who had administered the poison also cried pretentiously, knowing full well of their offence. When King Chitraketu heard of his son's death from unknown causes, he became almost blind. Because of his great affection from his son, his lamentation grew like a blazing fire. And as he went to see the dead child, he kept slipping and falling on the ground. Surrounded by his ministers and other officers and the learned Brahmins present, the king approached and fell unconscious at the child's feet, his hair and dress scattered. When the king, breathing heavily, regained consciousness, his eyes were tearful and he could not speak. When the queen saw her husband, King Chitraketu, emerge in great lamentation and saw the dead child, who was the only son in the family, she lamented in various ways. This increased the pain in the cause of the hearts of all the inhabitants of the palace, the ministers and all the brahmanas. The garland of flowers decorating the queen's head fell and her hair scattered. Falling tears melted the collyrium on her eyes and moistened her breast, which were covered with kumkum powder. As she lamented the loss of her son, her loud crying resembled the sweet sound of a kurari bird. Alas, O Providence, O Creator, you are certainly inexperienced in creation. For during the lifetime of a father, you have caused the death of his son, thus acting in opposition to your creative laws. If you are determined to contradict these laws, you are certainly the enemy of living entities and are never merciful. As Prabhupada mentions, this is the way a conditioned soul condemns the Supreme Creator when he meets reverses. Sometimes he accuses the Supreme Personality of Godhead of being crooked because some people are happy and some are not. Here the Queen blames Supreme Providence for her son's death. Following the creative laws, the father should die first and then his son. If the creative laws are changed according to the whims of Providence, then Providence certainly should not be considered merciful, but must be considered inimical to the created being. Actually, it is not the creator, but the conditioned soul who is inexperienced. He does not know how subtle laws of fruitive activity work. Without knowledge of these laws of nature, he ignorantly criticizes the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So one is just getting the karmic reaction for one's own mistakes. Therefore, you know, we understand that in one sense, as long as people are sinful and increase in their sinful activity, then you can expect there will be a rise in terror and terrorism throughout the world. It is not that in one sense it's not necessary. It appears in one sense innocent people are being killed. In another sense, everyone is suffering the results of their sinful activities over many, many lifetimes. That doesn't excuse someone for killing innocent people, such as women and children and people just going about their business, not engaged in warfare. Doesn't excuse them. One should not do that. But in another sense, it is happening because the people who are, in one sense, innocent, in other words, they're not, they're just going about their innocent daily business, but because of their karmic destiny, they will be slaughtered en masse, and therefore terrorism will increase, and therefore it can't be stopped by politics or by the if all the countries of the world unite together and try to fight terrorism. They'll not be successful because it's terrorism and such things are the result of one's karma. So, they can't change that destiny. The only way it can change is to engage people in pious activities and Krishna consciousness or God consciousness. But my Lord, you may say that there is no law that a father must die in the lifetime of his son and that a son must be born in the lifetime of his father, since everyone lives and dies according to his own fruit of activity. However, if fruit of activity is so strong that birth and death depend upon it, there is no need of a controller or God. Again, if you say that a controller is needed because the material energy does not have the power to act, one may answer that if the bonds of affection you have created are disturbed by fruit of action, No one will raise children with affection. Instead, everyone will cruelly neglect his children. Since you have cut the bonds of affection that compel a parent to raise his child, you appear inexperienced and unintelligent. So here we see that in the purport, Prabhupada first of all makes a statement that from the Brahma Samhita that one who is taking a Krishna consciousness, devotional service, is not affected by the results of karma. Hare Krishna. All right, so that's, keep that in mind. This verse, there was a lot of discussion about karma. So first, Prabhupada is clarifying. Above and beyond that, one engaged in devotional service is not affected by karma.
So does it
imply to some extent? Or? Yeah. So then he goes to just look at what is being stated about karma and destiny. So he says that in this verse, karma has been stressed on the basis of karma mamamsa philosophy, which says that one must act according to his karma and that a supreme controller must give the results of karma. The subtle laws of karma, which are controlled by the Supreme, cannot be understood by ordinary conditioned souls. So after stating the karma mamamsa philosophy, you know, Prabhupada is saying, well, ordinary conditioned souls can't really understand karma, so that's how you get these faulty philosophies of karma. Therefore Krishna says that one who can understand him and how he is acting, controlling everything by subtle laws, immediately becomes freed by his grace. So we can't understand the laws of karma if we're a conditioned soul, but if we come to the point of bhakti, devotional service, a transcendental position, and we take shelter of Krishna, then, you know, we can understand properly how the laws of karma act, and how, even to the point where you can become freed from those laws of karma, as he stated in his first sentence. And this is the statement of Brahma Samhita. One should take the devotional service without reservations and surrender everything to the supreme will of the Lord that will make one happy in this life and the next. So he hasn't discussed the whole karma mamamsa philosophy in depth. He's just presented that what's being said in this verse is according to the laws of karma mamamsa. That is a philosophy created by accepted by ordinary conditioned souls. And the devotees should not buy into that philosophy. Here within this verse, the philosophy of karma mamsa is being presented by conditioned souls, and as devotees, we should not accept that. So, you know, this is a verse of the Bhagavatam, but you know, let us not recite this as the way the universe works, karma and destiny. You know, we're not accepting it. Just like sometimes, sometimes Kamsa is, speaks a little philosophy. You know. But we know that Kamsa's philosophy is a little bit self-centered, a little bit poor. So, in the same way, we're not accepting the karma mamamsa interpretation of destiny as presented in this verse. And Prabhupada is telling us that, you know, we accept what is stated in the Brahma Samhita, that, devotional service is above karma. So according to the karma mamamsa philosophy, Work is supreme in itself. You do your work, and you get the result. That is the supreme law above everything. It's such a supreme power within the universe that if you do your work, if there is a God, they've got to give the result. See? So that law of karma is above everything. And even if there's God, he's got to give the result. Now, there are different problems with that. One is that you can actually literally step out of the whole cycle of karma by devotional service. And therefore, karma has no bearing on your life whatsoever and does not force you to take birth again when you go back to the spiritual world. So that's a inherent philosophy. Two is that although various demigods may be obliged to give the results of one's activities, Krishna, who is transcendental, is not obliged. He can act completely independently. He can act in such a way as to override a person's karma, to give them a little bit more, to give them a little bit less. He has that freedom. So it does not apply. So that karma amongst the philosophy has some significant shortcomings. So that's we see that, you know, Krishna preaches karma amongst the philosophy in the story with King Indra, you know, but he was speaking this that philosophy to get Indra angry. That's why he spoke it. Not because it's the actual truth. Just like in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, Krishna's very tricky. In Bhagavad Gita, you know, Krishna says even if you accept, you know, the say voidistic philosophy that everything is unmanifest in the beginning, manifest in the interim, and unmanifest again at the end, still you have no reason to not do your duty, Arjuna. So, you know, Krishna's sometimes, you know, there he's preaching that even if, you know, I'm teaching about the soul, but if you don't accept the soul and you accept the voidistic philosophy, still you have to fight this battle. So, and we see also that Krishna did the same thing with Indra. Even if you, you know, even if you accept the karma mamsa philosophy, and you've got you hold these demigods in such high regard above the transcendental Lord, still you should offer that food to, you know, Govardhan. Like that. So you're speaking in the same way.
Nanda Maharaj.
He's speaking karma mamsa philosophy. So, and even if you're thinking in those terms, So Krishna was speaking to Nanda. Yeah, thanks. So even if you're thinking in those terms, still don't offer that food to Indra. Offer to Govardhan. So and Krishna did the same to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. In other words, nothing. The only thing that really makes sense is to dedicate everything to the personality of Godhead. And you see that, you know, as Krishna, when he speaks in the Bhagavatam, when he speaks in the Bhagavad Gita, that, you know, the only thing makes sense is actually everything should be offered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Otherwise, and everything leads to that. My dear son, I am helpless and very much aggrieved. You should not give up my company. You should not, my dear son, so the king, I am helpless and very much aggrieved. You should not give up my company. Just look at your lamenting father. That's the queen speaking still here. We are helpless because without a son, we shall have to suffer the distress of going to the darkest, hellish regions. You are the only hope by which we can get out of the dark regions. Therefore, I request you not to go any further with the merciless Yama. So these are the Vedic injunctions that one must accept a wife just to beget a son who can deliver one from the clutches of Yamaraj. Unless one has a son to offer oblations to the Pitas or forefathers, one must suffer in Yamaraj's kingdom. King Chitraketu is very much aggrieved, thinking that because his son was going away with Yamaraj, he himself would again suffer. The subtle laws exist for the karmis. If one becomes a devotee, he has no more obligations to the laws of karma. So, as you can see, that the king was and the queen were thinking very much in terms of the law of karma. And that's for us as devotees. I mean, especially for me from a Western background, you think of Chitraketu and his wife, Kritajuti, thinking in these terms of karma, and it just keeps popping in your head, but why don't you just chant Hare Krishna, like that. But you can see when people are not Krishna conscious, this is their reality, like that they act. And of course, I have to bear that in mind a lot. We all do as preachers.
Because it's used, I mentioned several times, it's used quite loosely and insensitively, this word karma, union, the society of devotees. So how does that, do we bring this in mind then, or is it as a statement of Prabhupada?
Well, it depends in what context karma is used. Karma can just be used in the sense of doing an activity. Therefore, you have chapter 3, Karma Yoga, action, Krishna consciousness. So, karma, can mean action while you're thinking of Krishna. Karma can mean the reaction to your activities. Karma can mean, performing prescribed activities according to the Vedas. So, it depends what context it's there.
The attraction very strong for the family, unless that doesn't exist in the system, because family attachment is a very deep-rooted.
Yes, thing. So we have to, acknowledge that when we're preaching, that even for devotees, when devotees have a difficulty, especially in the older days in ISKCON. No matter what your problem was, if you ask another devotee, what should I do? They say, chant Hare Krishna. There was only one, I'm having so much trouble with my health, chant Hare Krishna. I've got a flat tire, chant Hare Krishna. My head dropped off, chant Hare Krishna. we're starting to learn that yes, chant Hare Krishna, and maybe you should do this, like make this little adjustment, do things like that. So, for devotees, what to speak of those who are new devotees with a lot of other different material concepts in the mind. What to speak of those who are not devotees at all, who just have, they really just think Hare Krishna is a, nice bar out people, So as we're preaching, guiding people, we do have to tune into the fact that, they are really fixed in their particular reality Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, according to one the particular modes of material nature, I make their faith strong. So when one is fixed in a particular mode of material nature, they always have some predominating deity or some, icon or personality that they identify, whether it be Adolf Hitler, you know, or, you know, Michael Jackson or what have you. They all have, you know, or Durga or Ganesh, not that, you know, I'm equating them on the same platform, but, you know, they all have some deity like that. And you sort of really have to accommodate that in order to help them to take the next step from where they are, not the next step from where we are. It's a big difference. And that's the art of preaching, is from where that person is, you know, it's how do they take the next step forward? And that's different from, well, just do what I'm doing, and I'm just going to chant an extra round on, you know, today. You know, they're not going to do that. So, my dear son, you have slept a long time now. Please, get up. Your playmates are calling you to play. Since you must be hungry, please get up and suck my breast and dissipate your lamentation. Dissipate our lamentation. My dear son, I am certainly most unfortunate, for I can no longer see your mild smiling. You have closed your eyes forever. I therefore conclude that you have been taken from this planet to another from which you will not return. My dear son, I can no longer hear your pleasing voice. And of course we see there that when a person is very, very much distressed in their circumstances, again, just to tell them that chant Hare Krishna, although that is, you know, if they could do that, that would be wonderful. But when a person is really distressed, their mind is just, lacks logic and reason and just goes, bounces from one place to the other with very little control. That has to be taken into consideration. Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued, accompanied by his wife, who was thus lamenting for her dead son, King Chitraketu began crying loudly with an open mouth, being greatly aggrieved. As the king and queen lamented, all their male and female followers joined them in crying. Because of the sudden accident, all the citizens of the kingdom were almost unconscious, and the great sage Angira understood that the king was almost dead. In an ocean of lamentation, he went there with Narada Rishi.
This is a question which people often ask devotees, and I think there was someone who came home who asked my mother this question as well. In that case, the family, the father passed away. The father was a devotee, so the whole family was in India, and the children were 6 and 8 or something like that. Actually, the father used to tell the kids always to chant, always, and even he used to take them to the temple, ISKCON temple. So he was a devotee, and suddenly when the whole family but him were in India, he had a heart attack and he passed away. Actually, he had the lordships in his family, and he really passed away. Apparently, he was actually chanting when he passed away. But the family were thinking that what is the use of this Krishna consciousness? They didn't save our father. We took our father away from us. Like the kids are thinking this. We took our father away from us when we were so young. Why didn't we do that?
Actually, he had brought up his, told his wife to just take care of the kids. We don't have to work. The usual, the typical is done. And she did not know how to drive a car. She did not.
So they were thinking that, like, you know, why does this happen? Why has Krishna done this to us? Like, if this is how he's going to deal with us, then what is the point of being Krishna conscious?
Mm.
So,
in fact, the kids have turned away from Krishna consciousness.
They have.
They have said that we don't want to go to the temple. We will not go.
Mm.
Actually, it's sad that the congregation is not really supporting the family.
But
yes.
How would you answer that question?
What is the question?
Why has Krishna done this to us? What is the point of Krishna consciousness if this is what is going to happen?
Yeah. I always think of it. I always think of a. I mean, I do a lot of, cremations, and some of them are really, difficult. They're not devotees at all, and they wanted a Hindu priest. They're always a little surprised when I turn up. But, the duty of the priest when someone leaves their body is to console, those grieving relatives, and at the same time, perform activities in order to, attract the blessings of Krishna and to purify everyone of the tamaguna. And even so much karma. So, all of those things are done. But you can't, the first thing that is supposed to be done is to console the grieving person. That's the first thing. And what happens is, quite often that's what devotees fail to do, that they may launch into a philosophical understanding or... without really emphasizing with the grief, and because from a devotee's perspective, they see them and they're thinking, oh, you're foolish people lamenting, over the body, and it can get very callous, in some stages. In New Zealand, there was one devotee. He was he was involved in an incident where a girl, I think she committed suicide, like she jumped in front of a car, and was sort of splattered. So, teenage girl splattered on the road. People stopped. And of course, everyone is just, absolutely mortified, really disturbed by the scene. And he gets out and starts, preaching. Oh, what are you all lamenting for? She's not the body, she's the soul. But it was the, it's that offhand, detached manner in which it is, stated. It's quite evident to everyone there that there's no real... that the person is literally callous, to what's actually just happened, and then they're going to stand there and preach philosophy, and it just seems like they're out of touch. Don't you understand? Someone's just been killed. Some girl's, lost her life like this. And when a devotee starts preaching without showing some commiseration, with what's actually happened, people just see them as a very callous person, in which case they probably are. So, the you know, what happens when you know these very distressing situations occur is that despite a devotee's level of realization, they actually have to understand the level of consciousness that the people they're dealing with are, you know, what is their level of consciousness? You know, for, you know, their level of grief is very significant, very deep, and it will affect them for life. And some of them will never recover sometimes from some of the grief that affects them. Like sometimes a devotee can, do things, deal with death, and then just, it affects them, significantly. But then they'll just within hours go about, their business because they're thinking about death every day, all day. You know, they're knowing that death is coming. They see that. They think in terms of birth and death. But for these other people, they put death out of their mind, and all of a sudden it's staring them right in the face, and they can't deal with it at all. So, devotees have to first tune into where people are and console them. As they, in one sense, share their grief to some degree. Devotees, properly are not actually just dry philosophical persons. Even though there is death and suffering, and they understand this is all temporary, it's illusory, and everything like that. Still, a devotee is significantly affected. So, just like Arjuna, he'd heard the Bhagavad Gita, he understood, that everyone is a spirit soul. We're doing, this battle is for Krishna, like that. But when his son was killed, he was just, he fell to the ground, he wept. He was inconsolable. He practically he couldn't function at all. But that wasn't that didn't mean that all of a sudden he'd fallen from Krishna consciousness or started acting like a materialist. What it means is that it's actually perfectly natural, because when because we're actually a spirit soul, we're a person, a devotee. They're called what is it? Paradukaduki. Parasukaduki.
Paradukaduki.
What is it? Paradukaduki. Whatever. Don't confuse me.
Paradukaduki.
Para?
Yeah.
Which means?
Unhappy.
They will feel sad. That's a devotee. Mm-hmm. Devotee feels sad when they see. Even though they think, it's illusory, you're not that body, but the fact that you're suffering so much, in the bodily concept still makes me unhappy. Therefore, devotees are working to help people get out of that suffering condition. They actually become unhappy. They actually, a devotee, they feel compassion. They don't, they become sad to see anyone suffer, even though there's an illusory nature. So it's not as if devotees, as they become devoted, they're just like fixed up in this philosophy and, someone dies or some terrible thing happens. Oh, it doesn't affect me, it's all Maya, like that. Actually, they feel very, very, deeply moved by, all of the events that happen to people. So, a devotee should be able to actually, commiserate, to have empathy for a person suffering. It doesn't mean that that devotee is also fallen. And that's what happens, is that sometimes devotees feel that if they share that you know, if they feel sad, as they're feeling sad, if other devotees see me doing that, they'll think I'm on the bodily concept of life, like that, and therefore they won't know that I'm actually really a pure devotee. But, you know, so, but it is a problem that's been there in ISKCON that, you know, devotees are frightened to be, in one sense, persons, you know, we might say human, not human in the sense of a materialist, but human in the sense of, you know, a devotee, you know, the transcendentalist, you know. They're scared to do that because they're scared that that'll be taken as a, you know, that they're in Maya for, you know, grieving like that. You know, and you know, like the story that you told me, you know, in most cases, in so many cases, when there is some difficulty in a person's life, you know, quite often, and to this very day, devotees just have this cold approach to it, you know, especially sometimes within the brahmachari, yes, brahmacharini, sannyas ashram. And, you know, therefore, like generally, you know, generally for marriages, it's supposed to be a grihastha. I'm not being political, but it's a fact because, you know, Prabhupada did it because there was no one else. There was no other spiritual masters. There was no other priests. Prabhupada did the marriage. But generally, sannyasis don't do that, nor especially brahmacharis. You know, brahmacharis are far less experienced with, you know, than sannyasis. So if you had the choice to do, someone had to, there was no grihasthas available, and you've got a very mature sannyas devotee and a very immature brahmachari, you get the sannyasi to do it. Because he's going to be able to deal, you know, in a much more mature way. But, because, you know, the tendency is there is to just have this sort of, you know, air of renunciation you know, which is incompatible with a wedding. You know, you know, wedding is where you actually what you're trying to do is, you know, the mantras that you're chanting is that you're trying to form a lifelong attachment within the heart of the couple. You want that. You want it to be, you know, you're not preaching, you know, just stay a bit separate from each other, you know, live together, but just, you know, don't really connect. You actually want them to, you know, bond in the heart, you know. So, you know, these things are probably done by grihasthas. But, so there's a lot of artificial things that, you know, go on in ISKCON, and therefore, you know, in general, we have a very poor history throughout the world with attracting our own children sometimes to devotional life because that air of, you know, false renunciation, you know, sometimes rubs off in the wrong way in family life like that. And children grow up very disenchanted with ISKCON, even though their parents are devoted to that. So you know, that's a, you know, a bit of a worldwide phenomenon that sort of still exists. you know, you know, this is where, you know, because we do have some teachers also of the children in the room. You know, we want the children to learn slokas, we want them to understand the philosophy and everything like that. But more so, we want the children to, you know, develop a very loving attachment to the devotees in ISKCON. And if we sacrifice that for slokas, you know, it's not going to hold them, it's not going to hold their attention, you know. You know, we actually have to endear the children. The men have to endear their wives to them. The wives have to endear their husbands to them. The parents have to endear the children to them. The children have to endear their parents, and the grandparents, so that people are attracted. You know, Prabhupada's philosophy was that you become a devotee, you become the best husband. You become the best mother, the best father. like that. Not that you become Krishna conscious, you know, these things are not important. No. You become the best member of society. You become the best mother. You're the best father, the best, you know. But we're not doing that. And that's what we have to do. So, that's good preaching, you know, preaching. So, that would be my, you know, observation on some of those things that happen, you know, in ISKCON. I've seen too much of it.
But even philosophically, for our understanding, what is the answer to the question, to that question? That why does this happen? Like, why does Krishna do these things? Even for our philosophical understanding.
Why do people die?
I guess it's equivalent.
People die because we have a material body.
I guess it's equivalent to the question: why does good things happen to bad people?
Because
bad things to good people. Like, I mean, it's the same question of why did the Pandavas have to suffer so much? Mm-hmm. Like Bhishma, they spoke about that in the first canto, 9 chapter. Even for our philosophical understanding, here is a family. The father is Krishna conscious. Mm-hmm. And it's a young family. He's bringing up his family in Krishna consciousness, and then suddenly the father has a heart attack. So even for our philosophical understanding, not necessarily for preaching to others.
Yeah. Well, you know, so I mean, your statement, which you're obviously repeating other statements, why did the Pandavas suffer so much? Did they suffer or did they endure great difficulty? They went through great difficulty. Whether you say that they suffered is a whole different matter. You know, so, for instance, there's a difference between enduring, you know, very trying circumstances and actually, you know, suffering. And you know, concomitant with a devotee is that, I used to remember, you know, on Sankirtan.
And just in line with that, there is mentioned that your Guru Maharaj had been mentioned that when he took sannyas, his son was also so much affected that he went away from consciousness.
Mm.
And then after this, he had to work to get him in.
He did, yeah.
Now, and in fact, he set him up. So, I mean, that's how it affects the kids.
Yeah.
I'm saying from that perspective, what can you do?
Yeah.
Because
he understood that something, you know, that his taking sannyas had an effect on his child, his boy, and when he saw that, then he endeavored to correct it and did correct it. So that's proper. And what often happens in ISKCON is that we don't even notice the effect, and even if we do, we don't correct it. We cover it over with some philosophy of, you know.
So what you're saying is the reaction of the children is normal, but the failure is in the society or congregation members who are not supported.
Yeah, if we're alienating, you know, our own family and children, then, you know, we have to correct that.
Sure.
That's not. Yeah.
You changed the question.
No, the question is the same. See, there, the kids would be affected that way. Because, see, this, you can't ask why he died. That's this karma, whatever.
That is a different question. Why do good things happen to bad people or bad things to good people? That is, it is the same thing. Bhishma, he asked the question, why did the Pandavas have to endure so much difficulty?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
He answered it himself.
Well, the answer to that question is this, that say someone, did a bank robbery, and what happens is that they go into hiding, and 20 years later they got a nice job, they're a teacher, they got their children, they stayed out of trouble, they haven't done anything, and all of a sudden out of the blue the police, link the DNA and realise this guy's the one who, and they come in, and everyone in the neighbourhood's thinking, he's such a nice guy, he lives with his kids, why they have to do like this? That's because, the reaction to his thieving finally caught up with him 20 years later.
Yeah.
See, so now he's a nice guy, but that doesn't mean that he's not going to be brought to justice. So, you get people who are in, say, the Second World War, putting Jewish people in concentration camps and torturing them and killing them and so many things, and then they go into hiding in a different country. And then someone's grandfather, and everyone's thinking, oh, he's such a lovely man, he's a grandfather, he gives all the kids lollies and sweets and the toy. All of a sudden he's being brought, why do that? He's such a lovely man, yes. But can all the lollies and sweets and cuddles that he's doing now as the lovely old man in the neighbourhood mean that he is not culpable for the extremely heinous activities he performed 30 years ago, he must be brought to justice. See? So that's what, when you say, why do bad things happen to good people, it's because that good person once did something bad. They're a good person now. Why does bad thing happen? Because one time they did something bad in a previous life. They can't remember, but the laws of karma do. Why do good things happen to bad people? They're bad now, but somewhere in their previous life, they did something good, and they're getting the results of it. But, just as people in the neighbourhood surprised when this lovely little grandfather-type person is dragged out of his house, they think, why? Because they can't see what he did 30 years ago. And similarly, we can't see what a person did in their past life, and that's the answer. If we just look now, but if we actually look at a person over many lifetimes, we can see, if I could see this soul over many lifetimes, then I'd understand why bad things have happened to this person who's good now.
Some people say in relation to that I should at least know what I've done wrong to be suffering now. At least the intelligence I should have. Otherwise it doesn't make any sense to me. That's some people... They
pose
that argument. So why doesn't God at least give me the intelligence to understand what I've done wrong, so that His suffering is more bearable?
When we accept this body, we are not given remembrance of our previous body, so that we can fully identify with this body. And if we had past memory of all our previous lives, then how could we identify with this body? And it's because we identify with this body that the reactions of our karma will take effect. Because we will perform an activity due to identifying with the body, and that activity is the karmic reaction taking place. So, identifying with the body is part of the process of karma, performing karma or performing activity, a material activity. If we remembered all our past lives, then we wouldn't perform the karma according to this body, and if we didn't perform the karma according to this body, we wouldn't get the reactions that were due.
What about when we see exalted devotees?
Yeah, that was my question. That's what I was going to say, because they're going through great ordeals is not the same as suffering. And that's what we're trying to, you know, teach people, that, you know, there's a difference between Arjun on the battlefield. He's also getting, you know, shot with arrows. He's also, you know, he lost his son through so many things. But, you know, concomitant with all of that is his love for Krishna and his love for all living entities. So, for instance, you know, when a soldier goes to war, they know that they're going to give up their life, and they know that they may never go home to their wife and children. But they take a higher pleasure knowing that their wife and children will have a freedom that they fought for. That if they didn't fight, their wife and children would not have, and they know that not only their wife and children, but all the citizens of the country will actually live in peace because of what they're going to, the sacrifice they're going to make. So that pleasure, that happiness, overrides, you know, being killed 1,000 times on the battlefield if it was possible. They would die again and again and again because there is a higher satisfaction of that, you know, selfless, you know, love in one sense. And that's what I was saying, that, you know, I remember, you know, going out on Sankirtan, and, you know, sometimes when things got really, really difficult, you know, and you sort of, you're getting to the point where you're sort of suffering, and then you think, Krishna must be so pleased that I'm actually undergoing so much for him. And that joy just overrides it all. You think, is it? You know, it is. It's like, this is so intense, you know. And then you for a second, you think, Krishna be watching this. I'm going through this for you, Krishna. I want to please you. And then you think, oh, you know, Krishna be pleased. And that happiness, or the spiritual master, you know, that happiness just, oh, and then you think, I'm so fortunate to be, you know, in a position where I'm actually able to, you know, go through so much anxiety for Krishna. What an opportunity, you know. So, you know, it's like, you know, Prabhupada going to the West. So much difficulty, but he's thinking, what an opportunity to, you know, sacrifice everything for Krishna like that. So, you know, you know, if you take, you know, husband and wife, sometimes they go to great pleasure. In one sense, they relish the opportunity to demonstrate the exclusive you know, very deep attachment and love they have for one another. And when that opportunity comes, like a great test, they relish it. Ah, this is the opportunity to demonstrate that. And that pleasure, and when they see that the beloved appreciates so much that loving reciprocation and returns that, you know, that overrides the difficulty. You know, in other words, you know, as Krishna says to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, happier the Kshatriyas, you know, that these opportunities come unsought, you know, to form their duty and to, you know, put their life on the line for, you know, religious principles. You know, I'm going to, you know, fight for religious principles. And who is the Lord of religious principles? My friend Krishna, you know, like that. So there's a transcendental pleasure, but even if you take the transcendental out of it, even materialists can understand this point of, you know, experiencing a higher form of selfless love despite the difficulties you're going through. That person is not suffering. They're relishing that love on a higher platform. Yeah.
Yeah, Krishna also knows who he is dealing with. We see the examples of Parikshit Maharaj, goes to die in 7 days. Haridas Thakur was beaten in 22 marketplaces. It is said that people normally cannot face three, you know. In three lips only they'll die, 22 marketplaces. And the Lord took it on himself.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a loving exchange, as you said,
yeah,
between the devotee and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
They there's competition, it is said, that between
yeah
the Lord and the devotees.
Yeah.
So that's a very high realm, you know,
mm-hmm,
in the past, so it's very difficult
yeah
to explain.
So even with, yeah, so that's a fact. But even without bringing in the transcendental point, actually, even on a material level, people should be able to understand that, you know, there is a level of happiness on the platform of selfless love, where someone is undergoing great sacrifices for someone else. So we can say it's suffering, but for the person who has this love in their heart, there's no difficulty. You know, like a mother, you know, for their child. You know, a mother's trying to protect her child from all sorts of dangers. And you say, oh, you must have suffered so much. You know, I didn't even think about it. I was just, you know, my attention was just on my child. You know, if you ask a mother who's been in a dangerous situation with her child, and they don't even think about what just happened, their focus is just on their child, like that. And it's only later, you know, people say, oh, you did this and this happened. And then they go into shock, you know, like that. And during the time, it's not there. It's just, you know, my child like that. So, you know, it's even on a material level, what to speak of transcendental, you're having that transcendental relationship with the Supreme Lord. So, you know, it's a mistake to say that, you know, they underwent so much suffering, devotees undergo so much suffering. That's their opinion, but even on a material level, that's, you know, they would want to look a little higher than that. But anyway, you know, as you can see, is you know, this story here brings up a lot of, you know, so many you know, quite a nice pastime which draws upon these aspects.
But here you feel bad because the children were going away from Krishna consciousness. That's what you feel.
Yeah, that shouldn't happen. Yeah.
The mother is struggling.
Mm.
Now it's actually 3 years since this has happened. Not,
mm,
not recent.
Mm.
Because she has to now take a job. She has to learn car driving. I mean, she's in a lot of stress.
Yeah. So that's not
and,
good.
And
but quite often devotees would just turn their back and say they're not good devotees.
Mm.
They don't have much faith. So don't bother with them. Appreciate someone who's got better faith.
This is apart from dealing with her own grief.
Mm.
Because she has been totally protected, now suddenly she has to do all that.
Mm.
And the kids are there, I mean, she doesn't have, and the kids are feeling that, oh, why should I be Krishna conscious?
Mm. Yeah.
How old are the kids?
Kids are small. The eldest is, I think, 10. Eldest is,
mm,
I think even younger than that.
Yeah.
The eldest is 10 now, the time the father died.
Yeah. So,
yeah,
let's say that this is why, you know, we study these things, because we should understand properly that, you know, as a society or as individual devotees, we shouldn't be callous to people in those circumstances and, you know, act in such a way that we're unable to reach them, you know, especially in a time of need, you know, when people probably more, you know, should get, feel supported by devotees.
This is New Zealand, though.
Yeah.
This family's based,
it happens everywhere. Mm.
So it's really
yeah,
speaking very badly of this one society. Based,
yeah.
If
yeah
the person is such a regular devotee and the singer not,
mm,
they should understand the situation. Okay, this lady is in this situation, and
yeah,
I mean, sort of take care of it.
Yeah,
so
I always remember the pastime of actually, you know, one time I was in New Zealand, and Prabhu Vishnu Swami Maharaj was giving a lecture. And in that lecture, you know, someone brought up about how devotees leave ISKCON. And he was saying that, you know, oh, look, you know, people leave ISKCON, you know, means, you know, there's some sincerity there, and, you know, this, that, and the other, like that. So I questioned that. and being a troublemaker. And I said, Maharaj, doesn't that go against the principles of humility? You know, that someone has some difficulty, so we say it's not our fault, it's just gone, it's their fault. And I said, you know, Śrīla Bhaktisiddhānta Sarasvati Thakura showed a whole different perspective, that when, you know, he was giving sannyas, and when the person he was going to give sannyas to, his wife came in and dragged him out of there and took him home and said, you're not taking sannyas, you're coming home to your family. And to everyone's surprise, Śrīla Bhaktisiddhānta Sarasvati Thakura, you know, was shedding, you know, profuse tears. And, you know, his disciples, you know, asking him, oh, you know, are you sad because, you know, I forget how they said it, like, you know, that he didn't take sannyas or, you know, somehow like that. That, you know, that he'd fallen away, you know. And he said, no, you know, I'm sad because I could not save him, you know, like, you know, the problem is with me. You know, they were asking the question like, you know, he fell down into mire like that. You know, is that what your major said? He's fallen down into mire like that. So that's, you know, that's generally how we can, you know, in ISKCON we can look like that. They're insincere, they've fallen into mire, mire's got them like that. But he was crying, no, I couldn't save him. I'm deficient, you know. What sort of devotee am I? What sort of guru am I? You know, what sort of, what, you know, what am I offering that I can't, you know. So it's that, anyway, I mentioned that to Prabhavishnu Swami Maharaj, and his answer, he said, actually, you're correct. And that is actually the proper mood. So, you know, he said something which was the usual ISKCON response, and then he corrected himself in class. And I thought that was good. What's that?
That's also not fair.
What's not fair?
A person who's having a family, he's married, he can't just leave the family and take some. That's not right. That's not right.
No, the point there was that a devotee...
The point there is not... You can tell him to be Krishna conscious in married life.
Why
bother stopping him? You take sannyas yourself. Yeah. Women can know that if men can
they have children.
That's
a good point.
What if the children are grown?
If children become grown,
no. Children could have been grown already.
Anyway, that's another whole conversation. Let's discuss sannyas or not taking sannyas next week. But for now, we got the point that when we preach, when we preach Krishna consciousness, we do have to try and, you know, understand the platform the person is on, so that we can identify with how they're thinking and not be callous to their suffering or their circumstances like that. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Class ended. I think I learned that in from